doesn't just come from a grocery store. Millions of farmers spend their lives producing the crops and raising the livestock that we eat and that we use. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld, and today we're bringing you Field Notes. It's a special broadcast from Harvest Public Media and our partners, KCUR, KBIA, WUIS, Iowa Public Radio, NET Nebraska, and KUNC. Harvest Public Media reporters are out in the fields talking to the real people that make our food system go. Today, we'll talk to them about some of the big issues they're watching. We'll talk about the rise of the local food movement, the ethanol industry and the corn farmers that feed it, climate change and how it will affect what we grow and what we eat. But first, we're talking about the policy behind it all, the Farm Bill. When President Obama finally signed the Agriculture Act of 2014, the new Farm Bill, into law in early February, many people sighed with relief. That includes farmers, of course, as well as advocates for food stamps. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explains, these two groups have been wedded together politically to generate urban and rural support for the Farm Bill. But it's been a rocky road.
To be sure, this has never been an easy marriage.
It's been an alliance and part of convenience.
That's Neil Hamilton, director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University in Des Moines.
This difficult process we went through over the last couple of years helped illuminate a lot of the fault lines and the places of tension between those different components of the political spectrum.
On the left, liberal nutrition advocates. On the right, fiscal conservatives looking to cut spending on food assistance and other programs. The Farm Bill actually expired in the fall of 2012, and it has taken years of negotiations to write the new one. Even though we call it the Farm Bill, it funds both farm subsidies and food stamps. In years past, linking the two in one bill meant most legislators had a vested interest in getting it done. But with Congress sharply divided on the funding for food stamps, called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the Farm Bill looked hopeless at times.
There was this rather startling thing that happened in June when the bill was defeated on the floor of the House, I think to the surprise certainly of a lot of the agricultural leaders.
Since the earliest farm supports in the 1930s, the link between those who grow food and those who need it has been part of federal agriculture policy. It became more urgent in the 1960s and 1970s as a way to keep urban lawmakers, eager to alleviate hunger in their districts, on board with farm subsidies. This time around, though, the tenuous relationship struggled to hang on.
Here's the vote. Here, Marsha Fudge was one of the ones who voted for it.
And then, Dan Looker is the business editor at Successful Farming magazine. He's looking at the roll call in the House on the final bill. Democrats tended to vote no because of food stamp cuts. Marsha Fudge of Cleveland is a notable urban exception. So did 63 Republicans, for a different reason.
In the final vote on the Farm Bill in the House, I understand there wasn't a single vote from Kansas for the bill, and that's very, very unusual.
Looker says it's a reflection of Tea Party conservatives, the minority of House Republicans who played a big part in stalling progress on the Farm Bill. They wanted to cut the SNAP program so much they even succeeded in breaking farm policy apart from nutrition at one point last summer. But Drake's Neil Hamilton says that effort led to something of a legal separation, not quite a divorce. The Tea Party Republicans raised their concerns and certainly slowed the process. But in the final bill, they didn't get the deep cuts they wanted.
The cuts in the SNAP program were much smaller than they had desired to get, probably smaller than they could have gotten if they would have endorsed the bill in June.
Hamilton says one thing lacking in this year's rhetoric was a strong demonstration of the two sides' interdependence.
I would hope that one of the lessons and things that may happen is that the agricultural sector, right, the commodity organizations and others, might more fully embrace the value of nutrition programs.
Because a few facts remain. Farmers grow food, among other things. Hungry people need food. Helen Jensen, an economist at Iowa State University, says the Farm Bill aims to help both groups.
Food is certainly tied very closely to agriculture and historically was tied in ways of looking at how do we use the agricultural product to support both people who are very hungry and also support farmers.
She says that although the pairing of farm and food policies got stretched and challenged this go-round, she thinks it's here to stay. And Dan Looker agrees, pointing out that this time, ag was coming off strong years and the overall economy was emerging from recession. If those roles are reversed next time, things could look quite different.
It's very possible that 5 years from now, food stamps won't be a huge issue, and farmers may need support from the Farm Bill more than they do today.
For richer or poorer, it looks like the sides can celebrate another anniversary before getting busy figuring out exactly how the new law will impact their operations. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And Amy Mayer joins us now to talk about the Farm Bill. Thanks so much for coming in, Amy.
Hi, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
So, Amy, you touched on this a bit in your story, but this was a particularly difficult Farm Bill process, right? I mean, it stretched out over years. So how long was Congress really working on this Farm Bill?
Certainly at least 3 years, perhaps 3.5 years. I did talk to someone who said he testified before a subcommittee back in the spring of 2010. So it was a long time. To be fair, it's appropriate for it to take a certain amount of time. These are never quick because there are so many components to them, but it was particularly prolonged this time.
Well, and you said so many components, and obviously in your story you talked about this marriage between politicians interested in preserving the food stamps program and other politicians who are looking out for farming interests. So that alliance usually makes drafting a farm bill go, you know, more smoothly, right?
That was one of the origins behind the alliance. I mean, way back going into the original federal ag policies in the 30s, there was a connection between hunger and farming. But that really manifested in the form of nutrition assistance, particularly for the urban poor and rural farmers in the 70s and 80s. That need is still there, but I think we saw this time that it's not necessarily enough to ensure that a farm bill gets through, and that has to do with some of the competing interests within those groups.
And particularly, I know, you know, we had in that piece, again, talking about the Tea Party and the rise of the Tea Party, that there's often, you know, some tension there.
Absolutely. I mean, we did have a presidential election in 2012, which was the year the Farm Bill was expiring, so that certainly delayed things. But at least as important was this real rift within the Republican Party in the House. They had the majority in the House, but it was really difficult to get a majority of Republicans to agree, both on the farming side and on the food stamp side.
So now that the Farm Bill is law, we mentioned President Obama signed it. It was passed by both houses. Finally, remind us, you know, just what's in it. What does this new Farm Bill change?
The most significant change for farmers is that they no longer receive direct payments, which was money they got just for essentially owning ag land. Instead, they have different programs that they can sign up for. And the primary safety net for them now becomes crop insurance instead of any kind of automatic payment. For consumers, some of the biggest changes will be limits on food stamps, and that affects certain states more than other states. And there is also about $1 billion in there for programs that include local food systems, organic farming, a lot of these programs that are quite small in the grand scheme of the federal budget, but much bigger now because of this Farm Bill.
So, you know, we talked about this being a difficult Farm Bill process and that it took such a long time. Why does a delay matter for farmers? Why is that important? I mean, you and I both report on agriculture, and we heard farmers for years frustrated that this process wasn't getting done. You know, why was that? Why is it important?
At one level, I think everybody can understand that not knowing what your budget is going to look like makes it more difficult to plan your year. If you have a regular salary, you know how much money you're going to get every month. For farmers, of course, their income always is going to depend on how well their crops grow. But in addition, what the federal policy is impacts how much they plant of one crop versus another crop, how much land they take out of production, decisions that can only be made in a certain window within a given year. And when a program ends and they don't know what will replace it, they have to make uninformed decisions about their land that are going to have ramifications 9 or 12 months later.
Or even years later.
Or possibly years later, right, especially with the case of federal programs that you have to commit to for a number of years.
And I think that
that frustration just highlights how tied many farmers are to some of these federal programs. I mean, a lot of them are incredibly important to farmers today, particularly when it comes to the farm safety net and that kind of thing.
A lot of the significance of the Farm Bill that maybe non-farmers don't realize is that federal agricultural policy is what allows farmers to live lives that look a lot like middle-class Americans in suburbs and cities. Most farmers in the Midwest are buying most of their food in the same places you and I buy it, from the farmer's market and the grocery store, and they're growing one or two crops or raising one kind of livestock. So these federal programs help to make it possible to have a career in agriculture and to be able to raise what you want to raise at the level you want to do it and not feel like you were always just one step ahead of being really, you know, financially insecure.
So you touched on this a little bit already, but the Farm Bill really is massive.
Yeah.
I mean, it has money.
It's huge.
That's the thing. It has money contained within it. It has budget for all sorts of different programs, right? I mean, can you run us through some of the kind of wide and varying array of things that the Farm Bill supports?
Sure. It would be difficult to recite the titles of them, but I mean, commodities and conservation are two of the biggest ones. Obviously, commodities mean something different in the Midwest than they mean in the Southeast, for example. There are also, within conservation, many more opportunities. There's not more programs. There are actually fewer programs, but more opportunities for farmers to make decisions about land stewardship. There are, as I mentioned, the local food programs. There are specific things for certain specific crops. It goes on and on. And of course, one of the important things farmers will be deciding is what type of federal protection program they want. And those have changed. I mean, that's a kind of level that is very important on the farm and not so important for consumers, but it has to do with how they choose to benefit from federal support programs for agriculture.
And then, of course, food stamps on the other side.
Which is 80% of the budget, right? I can't believe I didn't mention that in my little rundown there.
Just that little thing.
Of course.
You know, we only have just another 30 seconds left, but now that the Farm Bill is finally in place, you know, they can sit tight for a while, right? I mean, are we done?
There are other nutrition programs too besides food stamps. I don't think anyone feels like they can sit tight, but I'd say the lobbyists at least maybe are getting a little breathing room, maybe some ag business reporters. But no, there are plans people have to make and they're going to keep making them.
Onward.
That's right.
Amy Mayers, Harvest Public Media's reporter based at Iowa Public Radio in Ames, Iowa. Amy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll look at local farmers trying to put food on local tables. That's in a minute when Field Notes continues. You're listening to Field Notes, a special broadcast from Harvest Public Media. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. We're talking about some of the big underlying issues in our food system today. Local food is becoming more and more popular. The USDA says the local food market is already worth more than $1 billion here in the U.S. And anyone who's been to a farmer's market or signed up for a CSA can tell you it's easier than ever to find local food. Restaurants, schools, and other big buyers are also looking for local food, and they're looking for it year-round. Many of them are connecting with small farms on the internet. But not all local producers are on the cutting edge, or even on the power grid. Harvest Public Media's Peter Gray reports on a community of Amish in Illinois as they work out how to merge tradition with technology to sell the food they grow.
Clouds of steam billow from a straining horse's nose as dozens of Amish families rein in jet black buggies. They're at Rockholm Gardens in Arcola, Illinois. They've come from miles around to hear farmer Dave Bishop and other members of a USDA grant-funded food hub organization team.
This co-op model makes that much easier to do and much more likely to be successful.
The concept of a co-op-supplied food hub is simple. Growers join together to create the infrastructure they need to connect to big buyers, the tracking, marketing, and delivery systems, so they can sell local food at competitive wholesale prices. Restaurants, farmers markets, even a residence hall at the University of Illinois, 30 miles to the north, are clamoring for fresh products, but they need reliable delivery, and transportation is a special challenge for this horse and buggy crowd. That's why Bishop and his food hub team are working with the Amish to create a pickup and delivery route.
One truck comes to one place. All right, this creates the kind of efficiency in the system that makes it make sense. So there is no question that by forming a group or a co-op, you can accomplish a level of efficiency you just can't accomplish as individuals.
Food hubs across the country are using online ordering and communication to make local food systems affordable, but that puts the Amish, many in the Midwest, entirely off the grid at a special disadvantage. All Amish communities treat technology differently. Many have chosen to hire someone to handle their internet traffic, just as they might hire a driver for long-distance travel.
In terms of technology, the Amish make a sharp distinction between access to it and ownership of it.
Professor Donald Craybill of Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania is an expert on Old Order Amish. They're not going to use the heavy machinery modern crop farms require, so Craybill says producing local food makes sense for Amish communities that have always farmed.
It's just a perfect marriage made in Amish heaven, so to speak, between a movement among consumers as well as a very good products that are family friendly for the Amish.
This Amish community, struggling in an area where genetically modified corn and soybeans are king, is counting on the appetite for locally grown food to secure their future on the farm. These 8-week-old goat kids have a lot to say during my tour of Amish farmer Mervyn Graber's milking barn, but he asks that I not air his voice in this story out of respect for his beliefs. He is excited about the opportunities an Amish food hub could bring to the area, even if he's not prepared to connect to the internet. Graber does have solar panels to power his phone and fax machine. If he's any example, the Amish in the Midwest will find a creative solution to get farm fresh products to hungry customers. Peter Gray, Harvest Public Media.
And Peter Gray is here in the studio with me. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Peter.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So, Peter, we're talking about local food, and local food is certainly a hot topic right now. Do we have any idea of the scale of local food? You know, how much local food that farmers are producing?
Yeah, local food is definitely something that has been growing, especially in the Midwest. As of last year, there were about 200, just over 200 regional food hubs. Now, these food hubs, like I touched on in the piece, are really designed for people who aren't already operating a successful roadside farm stand, for example, the farmer's market model already being established. So those local food established business practices are already, you know, generating somewhere just under $5 billion in sales. Now, that was back in 2008. And the latest numbers just on food hub revenue from 2012 was about $3 million. Two-thirds of all of the food hubs that got surveyed last year had actually started up in the last 5 years. So this really is something that USDA is encouraging, and it seems that farmers are going for it.
So you touched on this a little bit in your story, but what's so difficult about making local food work? You know, why do we need things like food hubs? Why is the USDA trying to establish things like food hubs?
Well, what I kept hearing at the local community meeting of the Amish, who are working on setting up their farmers cooperative and that food hub in central Illinois, is what can we do better together that we can't do on our own? And what I kept hearing is we have generations of experience in the field or in the milking barn, but we're not salespeople. And we need someone to help be that go-between and help us find those markets for the products that we know how to produce, and we've been doing it for generations. We just don't know how to connect with a consumer.
When we say that food hubs are building the infrastructure that help local farmers, you know, what does that actually mean? Obviously, it is, as you said, about connecting farmers and consumers. How do some of the food hubs go about doing that?
Yeah, and when we talk about the term infrastructure, it's really two things. It's literally the brick and mortar structure, so a cold storage facility, a warehouse, a place where farmers can aggregate all of their products and then have it delivered to a restaurant or an institution, whoever the consumer may be. And then the infrastructure is also something that's more logistical, more idea-based, and also just setting up a website, for example, where consumers could go and getting that supply chain put in place.
Peter Gray is Harvest Public Media's reporter at WUIS in Springfield, Illinois. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy.
All right, stay with us. In just a minute, we're going to be talking about the ethanol industry and its place here in the Midwest. That's coming up here on Field Notes by Harvest Public Media. If you've driven through the Midwest, you know what a cornfield looks like. U.S. farmers are growing corn in record numbers, more than 80 million acres in 2011. Most of it is used in livestock feed, but increasingly more and more is being converted to ethanol and used as fuel. As the government pushes for more renewable fuels, that demand for ethanol has driven an increase in crop prices. That's meant rising profits for farmers and more money floating around farm towns. But now, the EPA wants to roll back the amount of ethanol mixed into the fuel supply for 2014. And that has Corn Belt farmers worried. Ethanol supporters warn that if the EPA follows through, the rural economy will take the fall. But Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports many economists actually predict a soft landing.
Central City, Nebraska is built around agriculture. On the east side of town is a Green Plains Energy ethanol plant. On the west side, Grosshands Implement. Kent Grosshands is the sixth generation to sell Case International tractors and other machinery. In the repair shed, diesel exhaust and country music linger in the air as he tells me why ethanol is important for Nebraska corn farmers.
Well, the ethanol plants have really increased the flow of grain. You know, it's allowed somebody else to compete with the local elevators, the Cargills, the Aurora Co-op in our area. So it's brought competition.
That competition equals higher corn prices and a big payoff for farmers and the Midwest economy. 70% of ethanol production in the U.S. happens in six states: Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Indiana. According to an analysis from Iowa State University, ethanol supports 46,000 jobs across the country, including 10,000 workers at plants like the one in Central City. Industry figures tend to be much higher, but it's fair to say ethanol has generally grown rural jobs and incomes. If you take part of that away,
everybody notices. From the restaurants to the hardware stores, everybody's going to notice a slowdown.
At least that's what many are concerned about as the EPA considers a U-turn in ethanol policy. The ethanol boom was driven by the renewable fuel standard passed by Congress in 2007 to jumpstart production of renewable fuels like ethanol. The law's original schedule required oil refiners to mix 14.4 billion gallons of corn ethanol with gasoline this year. But that's more than the normal blend of gasoline can handle. So the EPA is proposing to roll back the standard.
Ethanol supporters accused the EPA of gutting the RFS and putting the world economy at risk. At a rally in Des Moines, Republican Congressman Steve King of Iowa compared cutting the ethanol mandate to the farm crisis of the 1980s.
We can't allow this to happen again. We can't go through another set of the 80s. We can't be put into another downward spiral by a decision made at the top of the executive branch in the United States.
To relate the reduction in the RFS that's been proposed to the farm crisis in the 1980s suggests to me that the people making those claims haven't read the proposed revisions to the RFS and don't know what happened in the 1980s.
Iowa State economist Dave Swenson does not see economic devastation around the corner. He says the EPA is calling for about a 6% reduction in ethanol demand back to 2012 levels. And it's just a proposal. They haven't made a final decision yet. If it happens, yes, Swenson says, cutting the mandate would have a negative impact on the rural economy.
But how big of an impact has probably been overstated by many of the stakeholders.
Scott Irwin, an ag economist at the University of Illinois, agrees. For farmers, he says, the EPA proposal means lost potential. Ethanol plants won't use more corn this year, but they won't use less either.
The minimum level of corn that we're going to be using ethanol is someplace around 4.8 or 4.9 billion bushels. And the EPA rules stop us from going to 5.5 billion. That kind of change is not going to cause a disaster in farm incomes.
And if you ask Kent Grosshans in Central City, he's feeling optimistic. While times have been good, farmers have put money in the bank, so he's not that worried about what the EPA decides, at least in the short run.
I'm going to honestly answer you, no. We're not planning on it slowing down. Matter of fact, I've just hired another salesperson in our store because we're going to go after it.
But after 2014, things are less certain, thanks to a big drop in corn prices. The EPA's proposal to cut the ethanol mandate came as farmers brought in a record crop last fall. Prices are around break-even, and Grosshans says as the boom years end, farmers are anxious about what comes next.
Here we go now. They want to reduce the mandate. Other countries have started producing more corn. They've opened up more land. Here we go again. We're having an oversupply. I think they all feel that, you know, their world's kind of tightening up on them right now.
But in the end, whether the farm economy takes a turn for the worse may have more to do with the weather in Nebraska or Iowa than which way the wind blows in Washington. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And Grant Gerlach joins me in the studio here today. Hi, Grant.
Hey, Jeremy.
So, Grant, as we heard in your story, regulators are talking about cutting the amount of ethanol that's mixed into the fuel supply. So tell us, you know, why is that?
Well, it's because the government is mandating that oil companies use more ethanol than can actually be consumed in the fuel supply. And the blend, this situation is referred to as the blend wall, and it's a problem that everybody knew was going to happen someday, but it came along earlier than people anticipated. And that's because when the Renewable Fuel Standard was adopted back in 2007, Congress made this assumption that gasoline demand was going to increase and continue increasing through perpetuity. But instead, this recession came along, and that really changed everything. And instead of increasing, gas demand went down. And so this blend wall came earlier. And you can think of the blend wall just in terms of 10%. Almost all of the ethanol that's consumed in the U.S. is in the form of this 10% blend with gasoline called E10. And so if you take 10% of the fuel supply, that's how much ethanol easily fits into the fuel supply. That's around 13 billion gallons. But the mandate for this year would call for 14.4 billion gallons. So there's this 1.4 billion gallon gap that you really can't account for. And oil companies really complained heavily to the EPA saying, why are we being forced to buy all this ethanol? We don't have any place to put it. And this is really a burdensome regulation. And they asked the EPA to act. If you look at the EPA's position at this point, it looks like they're listening to those concerns. And that's the situation we're in now. They're dealing with that.
So we heard some pretty strong words there in your story, you know, bringing up the farm crisis of the 1980s. As we heard, that might be a bit overblown. But we are talking about an industry worth a lot of money for farmers in rural areas, right?
It's extremely important to corn farmers. And if you talk to a lot of corn farmers, they'll tell you that perhaps all of their corn goes to the ethanol plant, or, you know, it's one of the first places they go to sell their corn every year. It's a reliable customer of theirs. It's a place that they know will give them a good price. They really like having the ethanol plants in their backyard because it creates a lot of demand. And if you look back before this expansion in the ethanol industry, you can see why they're so excited about it. 10 years ago, the normal price for a bushel of corn might be around $2. In the last 5 years, we've seen it go over $4, $5, $6. During the drought, it went above $7, $8, this huge run-up in prices, which was really a great thing for farmers who are used to these steady but low prices for their corn. So they're interested in seeing not just ethanol continue as it has been. They'd like to see ethanol continue to grow because as long as that demand stays strong and continues to grow, they can anticipate getting a better price for what they're growing. And that's, you know, that's their main interest.
So ethanol, though, is a bit of a controversial topic in some circles, right? I mean, some say the demand for ethanol creates an incentive to grow way too much corn. So yeah. Can you kind of pull that apart for us?
Well, one of the biggest objections that really bothers environmental groups is when, as we've seen this run up in from ethanol, farmers breaking out ground to grow corn that in some cases we're talking about land that has been prairie. Maybe it's never been plowed before and now it's being plowed to raise corn. This is land that in some cases maybe ought not be used to raise corn. It's prone to erosion or really the soil isn't of that great a quality. So over the long term, there's a reason that it wasn't raising corn, but these prices are so good or have been so good that it really made sense to try to get as much corn in your bin as you possibly could. So that's a big complaint from environmental groups.
Plus, some say that the ethanol industry depends on corn subsidies from the government a little too heavily.
Yeah, and certainly corn farmers have their subsidies. There's the crop insurance that's subsidized by the government. There has been the direct payments, but that's changing in the new farm bill. But the main subsidies that have gone to the ethanol industry, the direct subsidies, actually most of those have gone away. There used to be a blender's credit that expired in, I think, 2012. Also a tariff on imported ethanol from Brazil that went away that really suppressed the competition for American ethanol. So most of those have gone away. Really, what they have now is the mandate. That's what they're leaning on, and that's why they're fighting so hard to keep the mandate in its current condition.
Grant Gerlach is a reporter for Harvest Public Media and NET Nebraska. He's based in Lincoln. Thanks for coming in, Grant.
You bet.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, climate change and what it might mean for farm country. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Field Notes, a special broadcast produced by Harvest Public Media. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. We're talking about big issues in our food system today with reporters from Harvest Public Media. If you want to learn more, you can find many of the stories we've talked about today on your public radio station's website or at harvestpublicmedia.org. So far, we've talked about the Farm Bill, food stamps, and the federal policies that farmers and ranchers work with every day. We've talked about growth issues in the local food movement and farmers using technology. And we've talked about ethanol and just how much the industry means for rural America. Now we'll shift gears from national issues to a global one. Climate change is seemingly on everyone's lips these days, but it stands to reason that farmers and ranchers will be especially affected by any changes in the climate. They already depend on the weather. So what will climate change do to the production of food here in the U.S.? Most climate models paint a bleak picture for the Great Plains a century from now. Scientists say it'll be warmer, and the air will be more rich with carbon dioxide. The degree of the changes is still unclear, but even small fluctuations in climate throw farmland ecosystems out of whack. That could be a boon to weeds. A new study shows certain invasive plant species will not only be able to withstand climate change, but thrive. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
So how about if we go this way?
Ellen Nelson has a weed problem. In the summer, one hillside of her small ranch near Bellevue, Colorado, turns bright yellow. The culprit? A tall, rubbery weed called Dalmatian toadflax.
See, there's these little rosettes. Just this much starts up in the fall.
Nelson pushes aside a layer of brown grass and snow to uncover the hibernating plant. It first shot out its showy golden flowers more than a decade ago on her property where she raises grass-fed beef. The plant is a pain. It crowds out native grasses that her cattle actually like to eat.
And it's such a tough, waxy plant that by the time it really gets going, the herbicide, you just can't get the herbicide in it.
The expensive herbicide is a relatively new weapon for Nelson. It's already cost her thousands of dollars. At first, she tried pulling the toad flax by hand, but the roots go deep and they can quickly regenerate. Then she brought in hundreds of weevils. They burrow deep and weaken the plant, but don't kill it outright. Lately, she's been putting her faith in her steers, convincing them toad flax doesn't taste so bad.
You kind of have to teach them about a new plant. I've gotten some of them to eat some, but in general, that's a hard one.
And each method has only worked marginally well. Nelson admits, so far, the toad flax is winning. As time progresses and climate change takes hold, it's likely to only get worse, not just for Nelson, but for ranchers across the Midwest and Rocky Mountain regions.
Right, there's Dalmatian toad flax.
U.S. Department of Agriculture researcher Dana Blumenthal wanted to know what effect climate change will have on large swaths of grassland. For about 8 years, Blumenthal and his team simulated a possible future climate, warmer and more concentrated with carbon dioxide, in the Wyoming grassland. Under those conditions, Dalmatian toad flax flourished, growing in size 13-fold.
The simplest reason that invasive species are likely to do well under future conditions is that they are pretty much by definition good at dealing with change.
And that's why Dalmatian toad flax could be emblematic of an even larger problem. Invasive species are invasive because they can adapt quickly. Similar studies across the country have shown other nasty weeds like yellow star thistle, red brome, and cheatgrass do well in warmer, more CO2-heavy conditions. But scientists need more data to make solid predictions.
There are going to be cases of invasive species, some of which we care a lot about, becoming much more problematic. And there are going to be cases of invasive species retreating from areas where they now exist. We don't know enough to say how common this is going to be yet.
It's an ecological balancing act, and ranchers face expensive headaches when weeds outcompete native grasses.
We are just treading water at the moment.
Steve Ryder is with the state of Colorado's Noxious Weed Management Program. He says, like managers in most states, his focus is on keeping new weeds out. If he has time left over, he goes after smaller populations that are quickly becoming problems, almost like stamping out spot wildfires. He says he's already stretched thin, and some weeds have gained a foothold.
If climate change is going to accelerate that, then we need to decide whether we're going to accelerate the response.
Back at Ellen Nelson's ranch outside Bellevue, she's formulating this year's plan of attack against Dalmatian toad flax. It'll likely be a mix of herbicide and burrowing bugs.
I mean, maybe we're going to have to learn how to live with some of these weeds. I don't know. That might be heretical to say.
But if the climate gets more and more hospitable to noxious weeds, it's heresy that many of her fellow ranchers will have to get used to. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
And Luke Runyon is here with me now to talk more about climate change. Thanks for coming on the show, Luke.
Thanks for having me.
So, Luke, we heard in your story that the climate models show a changing Midwest. Do they really predict changes within a century? And, you know, as far as the research you've done, what does it say that climate will look like?
I think a lot of the models vary depending on who you talk to and where you look at them. I think a time frame is probably pretty hard to pin down exactly how warm the climate is supposed to get or how concentrated it is with CO2, carbon dioxide it's supposed to get. But those do seem to be the general themes. While you can't pin down an exact time frame, most scientists would agree that within a certain amount of time, 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, our climate is going to be warmer and there is going to be more carbon dioxide in the climate. What that means, we don't really know yet.
The experiment that you reference in your story with the toad flax, so how did that work? You know, what did that actually look like?
It was set up in the Wyoming grassland, I think just outside Cheyenne. And this was an experiment that was set up by the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. They have a research arm. And they went out and set up this pretty elaborate system. So you would see, I'll try and describe it. So you have these rings out in the grassland piping. And so on the bottom layer, you would have carbon dioxide being pumped into these native grasses along with the invasive species that were planted there. And then on the top layer, you'd have these heating structures. And so you're trying to mimic what a possible future climate could look like, both warmer and more concentrated with carbon dioxide. And it went on for quite a long time. So scientists were going back out into the field for about 8 years, which is a really long time for a study and made it really expensive. I think the total tab was about $4 million for this study. So it was expensive and a lot of people were involved because they're curious about how these particular weeds are going to affect people as the climate changes.
In early February, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced a new program funded by the USDA. It established what they call climate hubs. So what are these climate hubs and why did the USDA decide to fund them?
These are hubs set up in existing USDA facilities across the country in different regions. And I think they were set up in part from President Obama putting a focus on climate change. But also, I think the USDA sometimes gets flack for not producing research that that focuses on the individual farmer or producing research that a farmer can go out and use in his fields. And so these climate hubs were set up as a way for the USDA to say, we're looking out for you and we want to produce something that you can use. So they're looking at existing research, new research about climate change, and then applying that to the individual farmer and saying, here's how the climate is going to change. Here's how that's going to affect your operation. And here are ways that you can adapt in order to survive under something that's totally out of your control.
So, you know, you go out there as a reporter covering kind of the agriculture and food beat, and you speak with a lot of farmers. You know, you talked about how this research is aimed at helping them kind of adapt in a changing climate. Is that something that you hear from them? I mean, do they talk when you're out there talking with farmers about climate change? Is it something that's on their radar generally? Is it something they're worried about?
I think it comes up a fair amount, just especially because it's in the mainstream consciousness. And so farmers are part of that and they talk about it. Whether it's a worry, I don't know. They talk about climate change, but the scientific consensus that scientists or that human beings are the ones who are causing it, that's a bit more political. And, you know, farmers are so tied to weather and climate. It's part of their business. And they've seen changes over time, and they're a lot more skeptical about climate change than I think the general population would be.
So you've spoken with a number of researchers looking at climate change in the Rockies, on the plains, in the Midwest. What kinds of projects are the researchers that you've spoken with working on? What types of things are they studying?
So this particular study that I was reporting on is mostly focusing on invasive weeds and invasive species, quite a few different ones that are kind of the bane of every rancher in the Rocky Mountains, trying to get rid of some of these weeds. But there's other studies being done on crops and how a warmer, more CO2-heavy environment could play into the growing season. So I know of research going on that shows, a lot of climate change research focuses on the warming. Now people are starting to move more into how the carbon dioxide is going to play into things. If you have more CO2 in the atmosphere, plants react differently to that, and that can play into the growing season as well.
So you bring up the growing season. I've read that a warming climate can make some crops grow faster. So that could be a good thing in some ways. You could maybe squeeze in, more growth cycles in any given year, that kind of thing. But it often results in reducing yields, though, too, right?
What's still unclear, and I think that a lot of research is trying to answer, is how climate change is going to affect precipitation, because that really plays into the growing season as well. We've seen drought and flood and these really extreme events, but what we don't know is over time whether really dry areas are going to become drier or really wet areas are become wetter or dry areas become wetter. We don't know that information yet. And like I mentioned, the carbon dioxide playing into climate change as well. Warming dries plants out, and that's where a lot of the media coverage has been, is on the warming. But we're also going to see more CO2, and CO2 allows plants to hold on to their moisture more than with the warming. So you have this kind of balance. Warming dries plants out, but carbon dioxide allows plants to hold on to their moisture. And so over time, it'll be a matter of monitoring that to see whether that's actually balancing out and not favoring one side or the other.
So we've talked here now about growing crops and climate change, but a change in climate will also impact livestock producers and ranchers. I mean, you've talked here about how ranchers may have to deal with more invasive species or the spread of some invasive species, that kind of thing. But also the beef industry, the hog industry, dairy, all these huge industries, in the Midwest. But they'll be changed by a changing climate too.
Sure. I mean, the animals themselves, who knows if they'll be able to adapt to a warmer climate. But also with the livestock industry, you also have a lot of ancillary inputs. So we talk a lot about feed costs. And if you're having a drier climate, you're not getting as much corn and wheat, the products that go into creating meat. If those are more expensive, that's only going to make meat products more expensive. And so I think it's really easy for us to talk about climate change because it's this global problem. But really, it ends up being a problem in everyone's backyards. I mean, it's right there, and it's going to affect a lot of different industries, agriculture among them.
Well, that's the thing, I think, listening to your piece, though, I was struck by the fact that we think climate change, we might think Al Gore, we might think, melting polar ice caps, we might think polar bears without a habitat. But, I mean, a changing climate is going to change, as you said, climate everywhere in everyone's backyards, and it's going to change all sorts of industries, chief among them agriculture, I think.
Yeah, I think the kind of flashpoint or the image that comes into people's heads is the rising seas. But even in the Midwest or in the Rocky Mountains, I mean, there's going to be effects everywhere because it is a global problem and it's happening on a global scale. It's easy to think of those incredibly visual things, but in cornfields in the Midwest, it'll be felt as well.
And I think, what you've talked about is so much about this uncertainty. I mean, ultimately, researchers are doing their best to honestly make their best educated guess as to what will happen. But there are so many, you know, almost unintended consequences down the line that when you change something as large as climate, you know, it's impossible, even doing an 8-year study, to really simulate exactly what this change in climate is going to look like, and, you know, what one change in climate will bring on, you know, in another area.
I think one thing that I learned doing this story is that if you get an ecologist starting talking about climate change, you can have a conversation that will go on for days. Just because ecologists, what they study is how things interact with one another, and climate plays such a big role in that. So people who study ecosystems, if you're having kind of a sea change within the climate, it's going to affect everything the entire way down, whether it's the food chain, how animals or plants interact with other things in the environment. It changes so much. And an ecologist will talk your ear off about it.
Well, and as you touched on in the piece and as we've spoken about, it seems like this is an area for further research and that there's more research, you know, coming online here. The USDA has obviously made this a priority as well. So it seems like, you know, we'll be getting more and more information as time goes on.
Absolutely. This was just one study about one very specific plant, Dalmatian toadflax. And what the researcher who I talked to, Dana Blumenthal, said during the piece is, you know, we have a lot more research we need to do because this is just one plant, you know, found in one part of the country. We really need to duplicate this for a lot of other plants in order to figure out what the entire ecosystem is going to act like.
Luke Runyon is a reporter at Harvest Public Media and KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. Luke, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for now. You've been listening to Field Notes. It's a special broadcast from Harvest Public Media, a public radio project that reports on food and agriculture in the Midwest. The show was produced today by Bill Anderson, and we had help from Peggy Lowe, Donna Vestal, and Frank Morris. Harvest Public Media is supported by our public radio partners, KCUR in Kansas City, KBIA in Central Missouri, KRCU in Southeastern Missouri, WUIS in Springfield, Illinois, WFIU and Earth Eats in Bloomington, Indiana, Iowa Public Radio, Tri-States Public Radio, NET Nebraska, Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence, High Plains Public Radio, and KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. You can find us online at harvestpublicmedia.org. Check us out on Twitter and Facebook at HarvestPM. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. You can find me on Twitter at JeremyHPM. Thanks for joining us here today on Field Notes.